Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. My only guest today is David Frum, the former Bush speechwriter whose conservative coat has partially turned, who is out with a Romana Clay about Washington and many of his old colleagues on the right, for whom he now mostly doesn't exist. Before David Frum, a few words about my own right-wing past. In 1972, I cast my first ever presidential vote against Richard Nixon because he wasn't conservative enough. I wasn't always a right-winger. My 8th grade world history teacher devoted a full period one day to a sympathetic lecture on Marx. When I got home, I announced to my parents that I was now a Marxist, and supplemented by a bit of reading, thought of myself as one for the next several years. But sometime in my senior year of high school, 1970, when the world was largely in rebellion, I had a collision with one of William Buckley's collections and Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. Subscriptions to National Review and the American Spectator soon followed. By graduation, I was a raving libertarian. In those days, movement conservatism was tiny, though it's hard to believe that now. I had no idea I was joining what in retrospect looks like a vanguard. Then we thought capitalism was doomed, but there was something honorable about the last stand. The moment I got to college, I joined Yale's Party of the Right. In 1971, Yale's traditions were under siege from a broad social rebellion, much of it very anti-capitalist. For a kid from an undistinguished New Jersey suburb who briefly wanted to join the ruling class, I was all very sad. The POR served as a repository for the old blue heritage. And what a repository it was. We had birchers, crypto-Nazis, neo-Confederates, monarchists, and drug-taking and gun-toting libertarians. I didn't last long. The milieu gave me the creeps, and I pretty quickly returned to my leftist roots. I did pay my former life a visit back in 2003 when I went to the POR's 50th anniversary banquet in New Haven. The centerpiece of a Party of the Right event is a toasting ritual organized around a green cup, a silver cup filled with a green punch. Toasts were raised to the Catholic Church, inspiring some hisses from the Episcopalians, the possession of absolute truth, which is one of the perquisites of party membership, to the murder of Ben Linder, the American Sandinista sympathizer who was killed by the Nicaraguan Contras in 1987, to the Crusades, to the British Empire and its American successor, and to the prospect of building a basilica in Riyadh and a cathedral in Mecca. Alas, prompted a call from the audience, "What about Jerusalem?" It was time to get on the train back to Grand Central. Back after a musical break. That was a bit of 20th Century Man by the Kinks from their 1971 album Muswell Hillbillies. That's number 10 on National Review's list of the 50 greatest conservative rock songs of all time. And that's a setup for my only guest today, David Frum. Frum was born in Toronto. His mother, the late Barbara Frum, was a famous Canadian journalist and TV broadcaster of liberal persuasion. As a teenager, he began moving right, and eager to play in a bigger pond than Canada's, crossed the 49th parallel to go to Yale College in the late 1970s. After writing for the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and the American Spectator, and doing a fellowship at the Manhattan Institute, he took a job with George W. Bush as a speechwriter. He was a vigorous cheerleader for the invasion of Iraq, though, as you'll hear in a few minutes, doesn't seem to be so eager to talk about that now. After leaving the Bush administration, Frum became a fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, one of the leading conservative D.C. think tanks. In 2010, after writing a piece arguing that the Republicans should have tried to change Obama's health care scheme rather than trying to block it, AEI fired him. It's also likely that part of the reason he was fired was for criticizing Fox News, specifically for saying that Republicans originally thought that Fox worked for us, and now we are discovering that we work for Fox. Earlier, he had quit as a columnist for National Review, saying that the conservative movement needed to do some thinking, and it would require distance from the Republican establishment to do that work. For these thoughts and deeds, Fromm is now a non-person to the conservative poobahs. Several months ago, Fromm self-published a novel called Patriots. Though fiction, it's populated with versions of some very recognizable characters. As you read it, you say, Grover Norquist, Michelle Malkin, Roger Ailes. The novel begins just after an Obama-like figure, Monroe Williams, loses his bid for re-election and is succeeded by a war hero general who just isn't right-wing enough for the hardcore, so the hardcore sets out to frustrate his compromising designs and wreck him if necessary. I found the novel very entertaining and perceptive, and occasionally quite funny. Its politics are far from mine, but so what? Which leads me to say this about my interviewing style. In what follows, I don't confront Fromm. I thought my mission in doing this was to find out how he and the further right think and work, and not to conduct a trial or a debate. I have plenty of opportunities to speak my own mind, and when I do interviews, I like to let my subjects speak their own. David Fromm. Welcome, David. First of all, I'm curious, you grew up in Toronto in media circles. I'm sure not many movement conservatives in the world you grew up in. How did you find your way to movement conservatism?
Well, I was, like a lot of us, a product of my times. I came of age in the system crisis of the late 70s, inflation, breakdown of social order, American retreat in the Cold War. And I was casting about for answers to the problem, why did the world seem to be falling apart around me? And conservatism had a series of answers to that question and a series of remedies to offer. And I think, by and large, those answers were right. And I think, by and large, those remedies worked at that time. And that's how I found myself in this movement from the late 70s, early 80s on.
But then you crossed the parallel, too, and came down here.
All of this happened while I was an undergraduate. I went to school in the United States. And that's where I really became political. I had had political impulses before I went to college. I was interested in the process of politics. I'd worked on campaigns, but I wouldn't say I really had political ideas. I shared, I suppose, my parents' politics, which best described as Cold War liberalism.
I met your wife at a book party years ago, and
yes.
She described her attitude as, I think she said we, meaning you as well, like, you had your noses pressed against the border like kids in the department store window.
Yeah.
Did you feel that way?
Yes. Well, there's definitely, look, if you've ever seen SCTV, that SCTV is the most important work ever done on the Canada-U.S. relationship, because it's all based on, in the early 60s, you could watch TV, Canadian TV, or you could watch Channel 29 from Buffalo, where they rebroadcast American situation comedies. And SCTV is an attempt to recreate Channel Buffalo's Channel 29 as seen from across the lake through the crackle and fizz. So yeah, we had very much that feeling. My grandmother was an American citizen, and my mother had been born in the United States, so I had probably more of a sense of connection to it than my wife did. But you definitely felt that things were, you know, this is where big issues were decided.
There's not much in the way of movement conservatism in Canada. Is there out in Alberta, are there some conservatives?
Canada has a lively conservative tradition, but it's very different. And what happened, the conservatism of Alberta was very much based on very traditional Western agrarian protest politics of a kind that in the United States often showed up on the left. In Canada, it tended to take form on the right.
Okay, so you got to the United States, and were there texts that were your conversion texts?
Yeah, I had the discovery of monetary economics and the economics of regulation. I took a course with a professor at Yale called Paul McAvoy, who was one of the great experts on the economics of regulation, hugely influenced by Friedman and Schwartz. It helped me to understand where the inflation was coming from. Why was it happening? Could it be stopped? I was very impressed by the Friedrich Hayek of the Constitution of Liberty. I was very impressed by James Q. Wilson. I mean, I was living in New Haven at a time when we were at the zenith of the American crime wave, and in one of the cities most plagued by the crime explosion. Why was there crime? What could be done about it? Was it a solvable problem?
Did you have the same youthful experience I did in the Party of the Right?
No, I never joined the Party of the Right. And that may be an early indicator that I was going to get into trouble, because when I met, I was involved in the political union, I was involved in the political party of the right, I've read your memoirs of it, and I met the people there, and they seemed to me kind of
bonkers.
Odd was the word I was going to use, but also sealed off, that they were not interested in participating in the larger life of the college. They had self-ghettoized, and I didn't want any part of that.
Now, I was there in the early 70s, and we were a really weird cell of about a dozen people. And by the late 70s, I imagine the population would have increased some.
Much, yes. There was a real conservative trend on that campus and maybe others in the late 70s and early 80s, responding to the crisis of the time. I mean, that we get an impress from the events of the world in our 20s that really shape us. And you can see that when you do political science and you look at, people who turn 20 in a certain five-year period will for life be more Republican or more Democrat than people who turn 20 in a different period.
So you said that your experience at the Party of the Right might have been a foreshadowing of your later evolution. How do you mean that?
Well, I've never wanted to be part of a cult. I've never been interested in politics that couldn't engage with people of different points of view, and I've always been suspicious of politics that tries to answer all of our human needs. Politics is a way of finding collective solutions to collective problems, but it's not the answer to everything that we as individuals have. And if all of your social life is supposed to take place in the same world as your political life, you're going to have a pretty constricted social life.
You never went to one of those port drinking sessions at the Party of the Right, did you?
Oh yeah, no, I went to some of them, and I enjoy. Look, there's some wonderful people. I have great friendships that date back to those days, and some of the I think most impressive people I know in contemporary conservative politics had their origin there. Walter Olson, who writes about regulatory issues for the Cato Institute, Peter Keisler, who's acting Attorney General in the Bush administration, and who, by the way, has followed a great deal of my own political, I should say I followed his. There were some wonderful people. Richard Brookhiser was there at that time. Very smart, capable people. But that world at that time was not a world for me.
You were in the Bush administration, what years?
For 2 years, 2001-2002.
Of course, you're credited with coining the axis of evil phrase.
Yeah. Well, it's like writing for the thing that is sort of bizarre about this is it's like writing for a president is like writing for the movies. You write in teams, and no important speech is ever any one person's work. And even on the rare occasions when it is, because you're writing in anticipation of what the president will say, it's his work. That your job is to try to assess what would the president say if he had enough time and energy to focus on this full-time himself. But it's not your job to, be the president. No one voted for you.
But looking back on that, any second thoughts or regrets about it?
Well, there are a lot of things in the Bush years to have second thoughts or regrets about. I have to say that particular speech and those particular words, I think, stand the test of time very well. Remember, the controversy back in 2002 was, could it possibly, it's not possible that North Korea and Iran could have a relationship of exchanging missile technology for nuclear weapons technology, because one is a Stalinist dictatorship and the other is a Shiite Islamic theocracy. And yet it turned out what everyone said was not possible was possible. The limits of that speech were that the president actually could not at that point, or felt he could not at that point, share enough about how much interconnection there was and the role of Pakistan in diffusing technology, or at least people inside Pakistan. But the idea that there was important cooperation between state sponsors of terror and state proliferators of nuclear technology, that's just true.
I was speaking with David Frum, author of the novel Patriots. And so let's turn to the novel. First of all, you self-published.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Fiction publishing is a world with very strict rules. And if you want to do it, there are certain paths that lead you to it. And I spent a lot of the fall of 2011 dealing with the publishing industry and decided in the end I would rather be my own publishing industry, and that's very possible nowadays. And I think we're already seeing more and more of it, and we will continue to see more and more of it. You can reach directly to readers. You can write the book the way you want to write it, up to the limits of your abilities, but you don't have to enter into a dialogue with an editor, and you don't have to be subject to a publisher's estimate of what that publisher thinks a particular market will bear.
I noticed when I got the book, there's no imprint on it. You didn't even invent a label for yourself.
I assume that most people would read it on a Kindle machine, actually. But that's turned out not to. Actually, more people are reading it on paperback, and you can get a paperback from Amazon. Actually, commercial bookstores can get paperbacks, too. There's a program where they can buy it from the manufacturer of the book.
Now, you, through the book, express considerable disillusionment or disenchantment with many of your former colleagues. Why did you do it as a novel and not as a nonfiction book?
Because there are things I wanted to. First, I wanted to entertain, and I wanted to reach an audience bigger than the Washington policy world. Second, the main themes of this novel are not about the conservative world. That's sort of the setting, but I wanted to talk about these larger questions, big questions of. The disconnect between the capital of the country and the nation in a time of economic distress. I wanted to work out some issues about the romantic relationships that I see among the generation younger than mine and the difficulties that people have in forming meaningful romantic relationships. And my anti-hero is caught in a very difficult... it's ultimately got kind of a happy ending, but it's not the relationship I think most readers of the book would want for themselves. And yet it's a relationship that has a lot of points of similarity, leaving aside the fact that they're very rich, with a lot of the situations that people now in their 20s find themselves in. I wanted to talk about problems of the what are the problems of the responsibilities of elites to the rest of the society. And I wanted to be able to not argue a point of view, but to let people talk amongst themselves. And one of the things I found most satisfying in fiction is when you write nonfiction, you take a point of view, you muster your data, and you back it up. When you write fiction, you can take a question, and you can have people work it out. And you can, as the author, reserve judgment as to who is right, and let the reader decide which of these voices that you write as well as you can is right.
I'm not going to hold you to a vulgar translation table, but there's certainly anybody who reads the book who knows the landscape well will see, you know, very familiar looking people, and yeah. You can certainly translate some of the names are even similar. You can do the work as you're reading, and people finish the book wondering, wow, you know, is this the way really so and so operates? What about the risk of that people will draw conclusions about very famous people that may or may not be true?
Look, a lot of the anecdotes in the book are true. They may not be true of the particular, but one of the ways it is fiction is I'll take a story that is a true story and a figure who's based on a real life figure, and then I'll mix something that figure did not do. But one of the stories in the book is there's this very poignant story about this great expert on Russian history, who has been commissioned by a big conservative think tank to write the definitive history of the Soviet Revolution. And he's written two great volumes, and now it's time to finish the third, and it's expensive because he has to go to Moscow to have access to the archives. And the foundation decides, you know what, Cold War's over, we're not interested anymore, and they stop the book. Well, that actually happened to a famous work of Cold War history, with the author, I'm probably not going to name the names, but somebody you would know, who wrote two great volumes, and the third had the funding yanked because it was 1991, and who was interested in Soviet communism anymore?
But then, of course, a very prominent player in the book is Fox News, which you call Patriot News. I mean, it would be hard to deny any similarity between those two. The picture you paint of Fox is of one that's kind of cynical. You know, that there's certainly there are people who are really hardcore, very fierce believers in their principles, but there are also a lot of people who are just like cynical people playing it for ratings.
Right.
How does that work out?
Well, that's one of the, I think there's one of the, what human beings can be cynical and also ferocious at the same time. And I think a lot of the leadership at Fox News, you know, you're a big lefty, and one of the things that there's an attitude sometimes prevalent on the left, which is there's an inner party and an outer party. And the outer party is watching Fox News and being duped, but the inner party is reading the Financial Times and they know what's really going on. But of course, the inner party is also watching Fox News. And the inner party is making up things knowing at the time that they're making them up, that they make them up. But then it gets into an echo chamber, and eventually you've heard it enough times yourself that you're not immune to the instrumentalities of propaganda that work on other people. It doesn't matter how rich and smart and powerful you are. You can be caught up in your own propaganda project, and that, I think, happens. So one of the head of this network that's in the book, we meet him briefly. We have a long encounter with his mistress, whom my protagonist Walter Schatzky inadvertently and recklessly has a brief affair with, and he's challenged. The network is challenged about the truth of what he puts on the air, and he said, "What we broadcast is a myth, but it's a myth that happens to be true." Which is an old line from Christian apologetics. And you often hear on the right, it's a much quoted, I think it was G.K. Chesterton maybe originally said it, but often quoted. And Walter is sort of baffled by this. And then the mistress explains that, you know, this man is actually conjuring a reality every day. And that's what makes him such a remarkable figure. And Walter says, so unlike most CEOs who think they're God, he actually is God.
Now, this is, of course, reminiscent of the crazy days of the Bush years when the Bush people busily creating their own reality. They were not living in the reality-based community.
Right, but creating your own reality is dangerous. I mean, because I think there is a real reality out there, and if you ignore the real reality, there's a story that an anecdote I've always loved. One of the New England transcendentalists, a woman named Margaret Fuller, used to do a party trick. Very striking looking woman, and she would throw open the door of the wherever she was, and she would walk out onto the lawn, and especially if there's a lot of lightning and thunder, and she'd stretch out her arms and she would say, "I embrace the universe," and her friends would all be very impressed. And somebody wrote a letter about this to a contemporary of theirs, Thomas Carlyle, who said, "She embraces the universe, by God, she'd better."
I'm speaking with David Frum about his novel Patriots. The Republican Party in there, who become the constitutionalists in fiction, is your protagonist works for one of the the remnants of the old-fashioned Republican Party, New England moderate Republican, and just kind of at odds with the rest of the party. It made me wonder precisely how, well, I've been wondering this for quite a while, precisely how the Republican Party came to be what it is, how the people like Senator Hazen have disappeared.
Yeah.
How did that happen, and who exactly does the party represent at this point?
Well, I'm glad you asked about this, because one of the things that people say about the book is all the villains in the book seem to be Republicans and conservatives, but it's also worth noting that all the heroes of the book are also Republicans and conservatives. And it's not just Senator Hazen, it's also, there's a newly elected president, President Pulaski, who's a hero of this imaginary war in Mexico, and he's got a kind of visionary scheme. He's elected in time of economic crisis, and he's got all kinds of ambitious plans, a big public works program to put people to work, then a fiscal tightening afterwards to balance the budget. He wants to end this war in Mexico, where he's been so badly wounded, but where he also distinguished himself. He has a vision of legalizing drugs as a source of revenue for the government because one of the cynical people around him says, "You mean move the taxes from the job creators to the potheads?" I like it. And he's there are other people too, but they encounter a cabal inside the party to try to stop them. That's the action of the book, the working of this cabal to try to stop a president who's got a huge mandate. He's won a big landslide victory, and he's a war hero. He should be able to lead the country, and he discovers that he can't. It's always worth remembering. I mean, this is a vast country. I mean, there are tens of millions of Republicans out there, and most of them are doing things like running stores, raising families, and they are highly pragmatic, practical people. When you turn on Bill O'Reilly, there may be 2 or 3 million people watching that show in a country of 300 million people.
Fewer people than watch SpongeBob SquarePants.
So it's very, they're the most active and engaged people, and of course they have disproportionate power. But it's important not to lose sight. And one of the things that I find most frustrating about politics now, Americans are problem-solving people in every other area of their life. whether you know, from commerce to organizing the way their towns work to personal relationships. I mean, the American life is about compromise and transaction and solving problems. And politics has become an exception to the normal rule of American life. And that's not the work of all of those tens of millions of people who normally are practical problem solvers. It's the work of a relatively few.
That was the first part of my interview with David Frum, author of the novel Patriots. Though you can get it in bookstores, it's self-published, so the best place to get it is via Amazon.com. After doing the interview, I realized I'd forgotten to ask him this question, so I emailed him for a response. The question: you write in the novel of a fictional, disastrous war with Mexico. A suspicious reader might see this as a stand-in for the Iraq War, but you have a history with that that you might find uncomfortable. Should a literary psychoanalyst see this as some sort of defensive displacement? Frum's answer, unedited: ha, I get psychoanalyzed a lot. 1. Mexico War is described as America's longest war, equals Afghanistan, not Iraq. 2. Plus it's a low-level insurgency in support of a fairly steady government, not a big unit war with hundreds of thousands of fighting troops. 3. I sought war in Mexico for the same reason I changed names of parties and generally avoided refs to all real-world events in U.S. history, except Civil War, to lift us out of the world of headlines and focus attention on the dynamics of characters and the main story. I learned recently that you are a literature student and not a trained economist, as I assumed, so I think you'll take my meaning. 4. I've been sketching a second novel entirely about the Iraq War and wanted to deal with that story at one time and in one place, separate from the D.C. story about Washington in time of Tea Party I wish to tell in Patriots. End of quote. I'm not sure that answers the question, but you get the idea. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break with part 2 of my interview with David Frum. Some of Iggy Pop's I'm a Conservative from 1980, which some people think is a satire. Dunno. Now here's part 2 of my interview with David Frum, the partial conservative turncoat, author of the novel Patriots. He resumes talking about the right-wing cabal that we were discussing just before the break.
Now, who is this cabal? Well, in the book, the cabal is the head of this cable news network, who is mostly motivated because he wants chaos for its own sake. It's good for ratings. I mean, as he at one point says, you know, I'm producing a show here, and you have been cast. And even if I liked what you were doing, I wouldn't support you. I don't happen to like it, but even if I did, I wouldn't support it because it's not good for me. So he's part of it. There are then two major villains in the book who are operate as individuals, one of whom is a true believer, and that's Elmer Larson, who runs a taxpayers group, and he in the book is a fanatically committed person with very strong principled beliefs. They're maybe unrealistic, maybe destructive, but they are ardently held. And then another character named Vernon Mallory, who is just who's on the make and who mobilizes fears, and in his case is xenophobic fears, for his own very particular advantage. And they symbolize, I think, a partnership that you see in a lot of politics. And by the way, I'm sure there are cognates in the Democratic Party, too, of the same kind of arrangement.
But the Democratic Party doesn't have the core beliefs or the passion that the Republicans seem to.
The Democratic Party is a much weaker... the Democratic Party is a party made out of many more pieces than the Republican Party, and the Democratic base is smaller than the Republican base, and therefore most of the time less ambitious because it knows it's a minority, whereas the Republican base, which is also a minority, doesn't know that it's a minority.
Now, a couple of points. This is kind of, you bring up a kind of intra-elite squabble that I think is relevant to this nature of the modern Republican Party. There's the it's the bondholders against the wealth creators,
yeah.
Or it, you know, it's the inherited money against the entrepreneurs. There's also the hedge fund and private equity guys against the banks who got the bailout.
Yeah.
Are these are these real tensions operating in the Republican Party?
I think they are, and there are many others. There's the fundamental one, I would say, is the tension between the interests of business leadership that is so important to the party, and older Americans who provide a lot of the voting muscle of the party. And I mean, my book is not a schematic. I'm not trying. I mean, it's a story. So there are all kinds of things, and there are all kinds of things that I don't tend to talk a lot about. But on the question of the question of elite responsibility is one that really interests me. We're becoming a more class-bound society, back the way we were 100-plus years ago. And that just seems to be baked in the cake. That's happening. And these great fortunes that are being accumulated, some of them will be left to foundations, but most of them will be bequeathed. And then we'll have a generation of heirs, in which, like in America between 1900 and 1930, a lot of the people in positions of power will be there because their parents were successful, their fathers were successful in business. And that's
a great passion for eliminating estate tax.
Yeah, I think a lot of things. That's part of it, yeah. And Walter's that person. And the question is, what responsibility, what role do such people have? And Walter wrestles with this. At one point, his mentor, Senator Hazen, quotes to him a sort of false Plato quote that you hear a lot, where to abstain from the political life is to consent to be governed by your inferiors. Walter's very clever girlfriend hears this and says, isn't that kind of the excuse? You go into government so as not to be governed by bad people, but maybe all the bad people who are there now went in for the same reason and became bad people just for the... And those are the kinds of problems that have to be worked out. Walter arrives at the end at a politics where, can't we do something? Just can't we? And that's the ending of the book. It's a kind of very diminuendo, upbeat ending where he does go into politics. He's going to be successful at it, pretty obviously, and he decides just to do a little something.
But is he going to end up being one of the bad people? Is the structure of the thing so corrupting and paralyzing that the good folks can't really try?
Off the last page, my responsibility, the plain blame, my responsibility comes to an end. And I don't quite know. I don't know if my next book, I'm working on another novel now. It doesn't deal with Walter. I may return to him later. But if I ended up with the feeling, no, Walter, he goes to the Senate to give away the punchline, as a successor to Senator Hazen. And he's obviously in every way a lesser man, less intelligent, less honorable, less sophisticated, and less connected to. I mean, Senator Hazen was born poor, and his father was a shopkeeper, and he's had to make his own way. Walter's done none of those things. But he's got a generous, the one thing he's got that buoys him is he's got a generous spirit. He hates gratuitous cruelty. And when it's equally little trouble to him, he'll do the nice thing rather than the hard thing, although he's sensual and lazy and not very disciplined. And at the end, that's the kind of politician I imagine him being. And he doesn't need to raise money. He's outside that system. And he becomes, then the ironic part is, of course, one of the reasons he's there is not because he's not going to be corrupted. He's part of the corruptors. And Hazen, who has no idea, Hazen has given him the roadmap to show him, here's how you buy people to get in. And Hazen, is throughout this, is saying, don't think I'm better than I am. I mean, they have a conversation at one point where Hazen's got a breast pocket full of checks he's collected from interest groups at a fundraiser, and this fundraiser, to meet Washington ethics rules, it says you can't serve dinner at a fundraiser. You can only serve snacks. What's the difference in a dinner and a snack? Dinner is anything eaten with a knife and fork. A snack is anything not eaten with a knife and fork. So if you serve a rack of lamb, that's dinner. If you serve hacked up lamb chops wrapped with little tinfoil on the end of the lamb chop, that's not dinner.
They can only eat Ethiopian food. So would you consider yourself, to paraphrase a famous conservative, did movement conservatism leave you, or did you leave it?
Oh, well, first, I'm not sure I've entirely I'm not sure either is entirely true. But the one thing I don't take the view, hey, I have exactly the same views that I've always had, the rest of the world has moved. First, I don't know why people think that's something to brag about. I've changed my mind about all kinds of things. And
yeah, I definitely have.
I met Tyrell at that same book party. I met your wife, and he said, I haven't changed my mind in 30 years.
Well, if you don't operate your bicycle for 30 years, it gets awfully creaky and immobilized, and the same would be true of your brain. I changed all kinds of things, both big things and small things. But the main thing I've changed my mind about in politics, and a lot of things I haven't, I mean, I'm still on the right-hand side of this political spectrum, but when I, at the beginning of my adult life, I thought the conservative world had offered America the following deal, that what we're going to do is build, out of the crisis of the 70s, build a new kind of economic order. And everything's going to be a lot less stable and predictable than it used to be for us as individuals. But collectively, actually, the system will have more stability. We're going to have fewer recessions. We're going to have less inflation, less boom and bust, and there will always be job opportunities somewhere. So we're not going to put as much of a welfare floor under people as they do in, say, Western Europe, because it will always be true that you can get in your car and drive 1,000 or 2,000 miles or 3,000 miles if need be, and it's your duty to do that, and there will be a job for you. Maybe not as good a job, but you'll have a chance. And out of that dynamism, it'll be better for us as a nation, and individuals know that that's their safety net. There will always be a job. And that actually did describe the economy of the United States from 1983 to 2007, a quarter century. And then it stops being true. And then we discover, actually, we hadn't solved the problem of how do you avoid extreme economic downturns. And a lot of those stabilizers that were built after the Depression turned out to be pretty useful. And so there's a problem that I think I, like a lot of people, I won't claim that this was a smart thing to have thought, but I will always say that I wasn't unsmart by myself. That turns out not to be true. And so the automatic stabilizers that were built after the Great Depression, you know, I have a lot more respect for their importance.
What about things like the SEC and Glass-Steagall and regulation of the financial system?
Yeah, those things I'm way less confident in, because I don't feel that I've got a really good handle on exactly the process by which the subprime industry, which was not that big compared to the U.S. economy, was able to plunge the whole economy into the whole world economy into such a disaster. And if I felt more sure that I knew what the answer to that was, I would be more attracted to specific regulatory answers. But I've read a lot about it, I've thought a lot about it. There are times when I believe somebody's answer, and then I discover other things that shake it. So we'll be talking about this for the next half century. How big was the subprime industry at its peak? $200 billion, something like that? The U.S. economy is $14 trillion. Somebody with an economy of $14 trillion has a total disaster in a $200 billion sector. How does that, and the planet's $80 billion, so how does that one sector wreck the whole planet?
Well, there's a lot of leverage around, not just in the subprime sector. I'm speaking with David Frum about his novel, Patriots. The book sort of implies that the way out is something like some spending cuts on the entitlement, something like Bowles Simpson, maybe a little more increase in taxes at the upper end.
The book is not offering that as a way. The book is not here to offer, this is not looking back.
What do you think, then?
Let me answer two questions, if I may. The book is not really about what is the policy response to the Great Recession.
Right.
The president has a particular policy response in mind, which is quickly sabotage. Walter has no blinking idea what the answer is.
He can't add two numbers in his head.
Right. So, and then this Bowles Simpson-like thing doesn't happen. But that's the book is about the process of why.
Right.
It's not about the Great Recession. My answer,
The implication of the process is that there should be some kind of compromise. That we need working across the aisles, and all this polarization is a bad thing.
The implication is what the president tries to do is he tries to lead from the front, the way he did as an army officer. He's very impatient with the political system, but he's also kind of sneaky. So he has a kind of scheme. And Hazen, who likes what the president's trying to do, is horrified by the way the president's trying to do it. Things don't work that way in Washington. And there's a speech which I modestly think is kind of moving, where the president says, "I want to do it this way, and afterwards, if I succeed, you can tell everybody what a bad guy I was and how much you deplore my methods." But as to if you're saying, what is my response to the Great Recession? I see at least the American segment of it as an economy that is weighted down by excess debt everywhere, and you can't have consumers and households begin to spend again until they feel less of a debt burden. And there we have a method of, you know, over time, across the board, without a lot of red tape, reducing the burden of debt, and it's called inflation. I think we need a burst of it, right? Not mega inflation, not 10% like we had in the Senate, but, you know, 3-4% inflation, and with a view to driving the indebtedness of the household sector down gradually. As it is, we're doing so that some households will default 100% on their debt, and most households will be burdened by 100% of their debt. I think it would be faster, fairer, and also, by the way, better for everybody if the rule were, actually almost all households will pay about 85-87% of their debt, but the rest of it will just be written off, and the creditors will have to take the hit. That's how we paid for World War II, and nobody complained too much about it at the time.
I'm speaking with David Frum about his novel, Patriots. Now, what about the distribution of income? I mean, certainly, you know, that has economic effects, but also a lot of what goes on in Washington, these think tanks and the payoffs and all, that has to do, it's because we have such a vast concentration of income at the top. Is that a problem to you?
It's an issue. There are parts of it that I find problematic and parts that, unlike you, I would not find problematic. Where concentration of wealth begins to turn into concentration of political power, then that's where I really begin to worry. That you can have, it shouldn't be true that one person can afford to pay for an entire presidential election. If you're at that point, you're in a danger zone. One of the Roman triumvirs said that nobody should be considered rich unless he can afford to pay for his own army. And okay, if you can afford to pay for your own army, that's a problem.
Yes. Well, New York City's mayor probably could.
So where turns into, but I think a lot of the concentration of, I mean, you see, it's not just a uniquely American phenomenon. You see concentrations of wealth everywhere, and I think, and it at the same time as we're seeing, by the way, greater equality of wealth as between the typical person across country lines. What we're seeing is more extreme inequality within countries, coupled with less extreme inequality between countries, and that's the great, probably the great seismic trend of our times. One of the villains of the book is a lobbyist named David Maurice, born with a different name, born David Moritz, who describes himself as an old anti-apartheid campaigner. That's how he got his start, and he now lives on a big spread on the eastern shore of Maryland, which he calls Mandela Farm.
That's a very nice touch.
And you know, he goes on this thing. He's always, you know, he's a lobbyist and he's a big advocate of globalization. He works for a lot of Indian companies moving jobs to the United States. And he says, "Well, let me tell you, as an old anti-apartheid complainer, I've always believed that justice is global."
Right. Yes. Yes. But he also makes a justice argument for one American losing a job that three Indians then gain. Right.
Right. That's his job. And he takes a piece of it.
So, are there any political figures you respect or admire?
Oh, so many. So many. And, I mean, it would be invidious to start rattling off names, but what I generally think with the American political system is the farther you get from the legislative branch of the U.S. government, of the federal government, the better it gets. So I think the executive branch, I think it's just always true, that the executive branch is better than the legislative branch. The executive branches of the non-federal governments are even more full of people, are even more impressive. That wherever you've got people who say there's a problem, you know, we've got a drought, and we have, my job is dealing with the fallout of drought. My job is figuring out how the Treasury can run bond operations at the lowest cost to the taxpayer. My job is measuring temperatures in the ocean. Those people are great, and the people who run those organizations tend to be people of very, very high caliber. And the problem of the legislative branch is one of the oldest problems in American government. And this is one of the places where I would come to some very different answers, I think, from where your politics probably lead you, which is I tend to believe, basically my view is that I believe in more power for the executive as opposed to the legislature. You get better people, and they will be more responsible.
Well, that sounds more technocratic.
It's Hamiltonian. And that's one of the things you say when you say, what do you continue to believe in? You know, a lot of those deep political divides, I'm a Hamiltonian, I always have been, I still am.
Well, actually, there are a few left Hamiltonians around who believe in power of central government as opposed to American federalism. The fragmentation of American government, all the checks and balances, and it leads to paralysis.
Well, I think the federal system is a great American asset. I don't think that the problem now is there's not enough power in the federal government. Most of the time, there's some places where I don't understand why you need 50 separate health insurance regulatory schemes. I think we'd do better if health insurance were regulated nationally, the way the Supreme Court said it should have been in the 1940s, and Congress then handed it back. But within the federal government, I think we have had a trend. Well, this is one of the paradoxes. We've had a trend away from the executive to the legislature, and we keep doing things with a view to making us healthier. More transparency, more power to the legislature, then more power to backbenchers within the legislature. And the things that the medicine we're taking is making us sicker. And one of the things that's sort of sobering to think about is whether, whether our the things that left and right tend to agree on is the things that are obviously good are maybe common illusions of our time. Transparency. Everybody believes it it would be better if more people had more instantaneous access to the internal workings of the executive branch. Now they may believe that in alternate 4-year periods.
Right. But this administration has not been shy about secrecy.
Right. No. Well, no administration ever is. But on the other hand, they post their visitor logs in real time on the internet, which I think is just an invitation to have everybody in the White House's time wasted by more. Hey, so and so came to visit. Why can't I come to?
Well,
visit?
Well, the real meetings have to happen off premises.
Well, exactly. And then this whole security system. And then a terrorist knows. Well, gee, if I just put a bomb in the Starbucks on 17th Street, I can kill a third of the executive office of the president right there because they're there to defeat all of these crazy transparency or the disclosure rules. I mean, the idea that everybody in the executive branch has to list every foreign trip they've taken over, I think, the past 15 years, the date they left the country and the date they returned, that people have to disclose every source of income they've had over the past 15 years. By the way, if you ever get a presidential commission for freelance writers, you have to disclose every article and every fee above $200.
I don't even have the records for something like that.
and then they'll tell you, well, just do your best. But of course, if you get it wrong and anybody's mad at you, that's perjury and you're in trouble.
Oh, finally, I mean, sometimes in darker moments, I think that all this paralysis and the power of money and corruption and public stupidity is a sign of a society that's really seriously falling apart. That this is imperial decline, the domestic effects of imperial decline, and that we can't even really identify or talk about the problem, much less figure out how to solve it. Is that too dark a view?
Well, I don't. It may. Someday it will be right. But there are all these studies about how we spend X percent of your lifetime health spending in your last 6 weeks of life. And probably most of us, with regard to our responsibilities, well, if I were sure this were my last 6 weeks of life, then I would say, but maybe I've just got a really bad pneumonia, and it's like, and actually I'm going to live for 10 more years and then have my last 6 weeks. We don't know when the American system will go into decline. But it's our duty to act as if it's not going to happen on our watch. And we are not going to let it happen. And I don't believe in passivity. And someday, some generation of Americans will be wrong. They will think, well, this decline, we can arrest it, and they won't. They'll have problems too big for them. But for now, I'm with Walter, that in politics, it's your job to do the best you can, subject to your limits, we all have them, and to try to make things a little bit better for the country and for the people living in it.
And that was David Frum, the conservative pundit who's alienated his old comrades on the right with his criticism of their unthinking orthodoxies. His novel Patriots is a roman of Clay about Washington viewed mainly through the institution of a contemporary right. It's self-published and available most easily from Amazon. A funny bit from the book. Elmer Larson, who appears based on Grover Norquist, says, "The American people don't resent money. People look at rich guys and say, someday I'm going to make it big myself, then I'll buy the big house, the golf vacations, the boat, and yeah, the private plane, too. So long as a rich guy spends his money the way people would spend it, they understand and accept it. You know how a rich guy loses the American people? How? When he buys modern art. Then they think he's making fun of them." That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this very anti-conservative song, The Internazionale, performed by Stefan Grappelli, from the soundtrack to Louis Malle's 1990 film, Milieu Amai. Till next week, bye.